Welcome to episode 4 of the Bitcoin Boomers. I'm Bob Burnett. I'm here with my co-hosts, Gary Leland and Lawrence Lepard. And today we have a special guest named John Highbush. John is an old friend of mine. We worked together back about 30 years ago while I was at Gateway and have kept in touch since we both went into other pastures. In our first episode of this series, we had a gentleman by the name of George Bodine, and we introduced him as potentially the most interesting man in the world. But I do think we have another candidate here. John, and we'll go into the details of his history, but John has had a varied and illustrious career in politics, in business, in writing, in philanthropy. We're going to dig into a whole bunch of it, but welcome, John. I'm so glad you could join us.
Hey, great to be with you, Bob, Lawrence, and Andy, or Gary.
Gary. So, John, I think, I alluded to some of the various hats you've worn kind of in your life, and I'm being serious, by the way, not in jest, that you've led a tremendously interesting life. I think a lot of us have been blessed to have done so, but you've touched a lot of lives and seen a lot of things. You and I having a personal relationship, I know some things that maybe some others wouldn't know. But I thought just to kind of maybe get people acclimated and introduced to you, We could talk about a few of the things that you've seen in your life. And you know, one of the things I've always found really interesting is you had the opportunity to have dinner with Lady Di. And not many people have had that.
We had a date with Lady Di.
Oh, well, excuse me.
Yeah, I mean, let's upgrade this a little bit.
Yes. I'm sorry to shortchange you, John. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that, how you came to have a date with Lady Di and any observations you might have about her.
Okay.
That's a Where'd good you take her? That's what I want to know.
It's part of the story. No, so I started my career as a young man working in the Pentagon, and that's little job, almost a nothing job, but moved on to Capitol Hill. And so I was in politics for the first part of my career and jumped from Capitol Hill. This is during the Reagan presidency, and became Elizabeth Dole's chief of staff when she was Secretary of Labor for President George H.W. Bush. And when I was chief of staff at Labor for 2 years, then jumped over to the American Red Cross of all places, because Elizabeth was the first cabinet secretary to leave the Bush administration, make that jump, and she asked me to come over with her. And I told her at the time, you know, the only thing I know about the Red Cross, Elizabeth, is they taught me how to swim, I think. And
that's a good thing to learn.
Yeah, really. So I was the number three, and then the number two under Elizabeth at Red Cross. And she's an incredibly bright Harvard-trained lawyer, an incredible personality, hugely smart. She did so many things while at the Red Cross. One of them was she struck up a friendship with Lady Diana, who at the time was the British ambassador for the Red Cross worldwide. And Diana was, as you might remember from that time, was all about landmines and removing landmines from war-torn nations. And she came over to visit the United States at a time when I had just made the move from running this big national party committee to Gateway Computers, in fact. And so, Bob, I know you well recall our good friend and CEO, Ted Waite. So mm-hmm. I was only on the job at Gateway for a couple of months, and I was in Ted's office, and the phone rang. And actually, Ted's secretary came in and said, John, there's a call for you. And I was in this intense discussion with Ted. So I'm like, I'll just tell whoever it is, I'll call him back. So then she comes back and goes, no, they really insist you take the call. And I started feeling bad because I'm like, Ted's going to get mad here. You know, what is it? So I said, look, I don't care who it is. I'm in a meeting. She comes back a third time and she opens the door to Ted, says, just take the stupid call. I pick up the phone and there's nobody on the line, but there's a recording and it's Frank Sinatra singing Happy Birthday. And when it gets to Happy Birthday, I hear Elizabeth's voice, which she says, John. And at the end of the recording, it's another recording from Elizabeth, which says, just wanted to wish you happy birthday. And as a birthday present, I'd like to know if you'd like to go on a date with Lady Diana. So, like, yeah, Ted, this meeting's over. And I flew back, and for my birthday, she and Bob Dole, her husband, were entertaining Diana, who was on a visit to D.C. for the Red Cross purposes. And we all went out for a dinner and a date, and it just blew my mind. Because I, at the time, I don't know how many American males, I was single at the time, were in love with Lady Diana, but I sure was. And so I sat there drooling through most of the dinner. And it was an experience I'll never forget. She had incredibly bright, great sense of humor, really thoughtful person. It was just, it was one of the funnest nights of my life, I think.
That's fabulous. So that would have been like, what, me, John, like 98, 97, 98, yeah, something like that?
Well, yeah, 97. It was 97.
97. Yeah,
she had gone through her divorce and separated and all that, and she was not yet dating that guy, Dodi Fayed. But she was right in that moment where she was single and fancy free.
Right. Yeah. Now John has a lovely wife. Her name's Marcella. He did very well.
Yeah, don't tell her this Lady Di story either. She would not.
So life was very kind, and she's a wonderful woman. I'm sure the right thing happened. But imagine how different history might be had this gone a different direction. Wow.
Yeah. No, one of the most, I don't know, pretty tough moments is I wasn't that much further. I don't know, maybe it was 6 or 8 months. I won't get the dates right. But then she dies crashing in that tunnel in Paris. It was like, oh, you know, when that kind of thing happens, and you just relatively recently have been with her, was really striking.
Yeah. Now, at the time, John, were we in San Diego at that point?
Not yet. No.
Were you in Poway?
Still in Sioux City.
We're still in Sioux City?
Yeah.
We're in Sioux City at that time. Okay. So, Larry or Gary, you got any comments on that?
I have no comments about Lady Di, except that's a great story for sure. Yeah. To be able to say. I met Elizabeth Dole one time. She was here in town for... I can't remember what it was. It was there was a Senator Hutchinson, I think. She was here at an event for her. I don't know. Were you with her at that?
No, at that time, when I went from the Red Cross, I got invited to run one of the big national Republican Party committees in Washington, D.C. And I think that's right about the time you probably saw her. I ran the committee that raises enormous amounts of money and does candidate selection for the Republicans in the United States Senate. And so it's a job you only hold for 2 years, every election cycle. And we succeeded in growing the Republican majority to 55 seats, which what at the time was a historic high. And but that very same time frame, I was supporting her husband, Bob, who was running for president at the time. So. Yeah,
I met him at another function later in the year. Both of them, though, and maybe it's because they were politicians, basically, but both of them were great people to talk with.
You bet. I mean, Bob Dole had the wryest, best Midwest sense of humor that you would ever meet. I mean, really an incredible guy. So, but yeah, my jobs, the first half of my life was just pure politics. and nonprofit. And then I had, I literally remember I was, when I was chief of staff at Labor, I was meeting with all these major business figures, you know, the CEO of McDonald's and all the rest. And I sat there during the conversation with one of them thinking, you know what, this is interesting. I don't know the first thing about business. Not but for, I mean, I knew politics and all the rest, but I, it was this huge hole in my resume. So, and that's when I had all these job offers to be a lobbyist in DC, but Gateway called me. And I thought, what is this? Who's that? Yeah, well, they're this little computer startup in the middle of a cornfield in Iowa. And I said, I got to check this out. And that's how I got introduced to the tech space and business. And, you know, the rest is history.
And I guess Bob, that's how you met Bob.
Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. Right. That's where John and I intersected. And, you know, I think it's really cool, John. I don't know that I've ever heard you say what you just said, which was that you had that realization that you didn't understand and didn't have this experience in the business side. And, you know, I think that's one of the huge problems with the political base today is, you know, I do have to interface in my current role with lots of people in Washington, and it is shocking how little business acumen they have, how little understanding of the way business really works, and yet they're creating the regulations, they're creating the laws, and it's scary as shit.
Yeah, you bet it is. And you know, to some extent, Bob, that's in part a matter of age, and I say that because, you know, when I was 25 years old as a legislative director working on Capitol Hill, I succeeded in killing a defense platform, a weapon system, put tens of thousands of people out of business, $5 billion, you know, went away. You know, I mean, there, when you're those jobs at a very young age, you get placed with an enormous amount of responsibility, and you don't even barely understand the world right near you, much less, you know, everything around you. And it's, and so there's a, at a young age, you have a lot of power, but not a lot of knowledge. And, you know, you, of course you gain knowledge as you move forward, but so much of our, you know, many, many, many of the people that have exceeded to the highest level in politics have never worked a day in their life outside of public office, and no, you know, they take tours of business. Yeah. But they don't understand them, you know. So it's right. A real flaw in our system. I'm not sure how to fix it. I definitely support term limits, you know, because if we could, there's just too much power concentration and people wanting to spend their career in Washington rather than, you know, actually go out and be a real person somewhere.
Well, John, since you've been in that field, I guess, do you think that's ever going to be possible to get term limits, since they have to vote on like cutting their careers out?
You know, well, I'll put it this way. See, I've always been right of center on the conservative end of the political spectrum. And I've worked for members of Congress and in administrations where if we could cut federal government spending in half, I'm in. You know, how do we get there, right? Mm-hmm. And because it's the national debt and what it has done to this nation, the whole monetary system, everything, it's just, it is so extremely flawed. And the problem is, if you're an average member of Congress or the Senate, there's nothing in it for you to cut spending. I mean, it's, you know, it puts you in trouble during election time. And so they accumulate this power by continuing to give it away, you know, spend beyond our means. And so now we've got a $37 trillion national debt. I think term limits come around when this nation ends up upside down into some kind of a revolution where people have just frankly had enough. I mean, and do I see that day in the near term? No. But that is definitely where we're heading. We are heading off a cliff, a fiscal cliff. And it's because there's no discipline in the system.
We all agree strongly.
Well, I don't think there's anyone here who disagrees with you.
Yeah, that's a fourth term. We got to reset it. John, I'm curious. I was doing the research on your background, and I noticed a strong connection to Reagan, who I admire, and to Nancy Reagan as well. Can you kind of walk us through some of that, just because I'd love to hear the firsthand stories of the two of them. Do you know what I mean? You must have seen things that the three of us would never have seen, you know?
Yeah, sure. Well, I've been to the White House hundreds of times. I never worked directly for Ronald Reagan. I met him many times. I was in meetings with him, and I worked a lot for Mrs. Reagan. But on Capitol Hill, the congressman I worked for, he got swept in on Reagan's coattails in 1980, just like many others did. And we had this fairly liberal district, which was not easy to get reelected in as a conservative.
Where was it? What state was it from?
Fifth district of Oregon. So that Portland suburbs down through Salem, the Willamette Valley, that whole area. And so to be pro-Reagan and pro-Reagan economics at the time was a near death sentence, but that's what we were. Not at all. Yeah. So I spent 8 years in a touch and go situation where, every 2 years you thought I'm going to be out of a job because he was, he voted consistently with Reagan. And Reagan was all about less taxes, less regulation, cut federal spending and strong defense. That wasn't what Oregon wanted. That was for sure. So anyways, my first day on the job as a young kid on Capitol Hill, I got to run across the street and watch Reagan hold up his hand, take the oath of office. And then my last day on Capitol Hill, I got invited down to the White House, shake his hand, and watch him get on the helicopter. And they circled the city a couple of times before he went back west. But I had been engaged in many, many issues that Reagan was involved in. So having been around him on the legislative side, I got to know him, Mrs. Reagan. And so then I went off of my career thinking, well, that's probably the end of my Reagan connection. But after I left Gateway and did some other things, Mrs. Reagan called me and said, hey, John, would you consider running the Reagan Library? And I was living in La Jolla at the time. And I thought first, I was with my son. We were in a toy store. He's like 5 years old, screaming. And hi, John, this is Nancy Reagan. And I said, yeah, right. Then there was silence. So then I thought, this might really be, it's kind of sounded like her. So they said, no, I'd like you to consider moving up to LA. I was living in La Jolla. Consider moving up here and run the Reagan Library. Oh, God. I said, well, Mrs. Reagan, can I ask you one question? Yeah. Would you consider moving the Reagan Library to La Jolla? I just didn't want to move. And she said, no. Okay. 6 months later, there I was moving to LA and running the Reagan Library. So, and when you run the Reagan Library, between Mrs. Reagan and everybody and anybody that ever worked for him, they go through there. And I mean, it's just a Reagan fest, So I spent 13 years doing that. That's where some of these stories come in, you were talking before we went on air about finding a vial of Reagan's blood. I mean, that was kind of a unique situation, and I fought my tail off to make sure we fixed that, and we did, but it took a lot of effort.
Tell that story. Yeah, John, tell that story.
Well, you might remember when Reagan was when Hinckley attempted to assassinate him, in Washington, D.C., outside the hotel. Reagan didn't know he was shot. He got shoved in the limousine, and he thought the Secret Service agent might have broken a rib when he pushed him in. And he just said, let's get back to the White House. And then the Secret Service agent noticed that blood was starting to form on his lips. And he said, bullshit, we're going straight to GW Hospital. And they went into the hospital. And so when Reagan... they pulled the bullet out of him, and he had lost, believe this or not, he had lost one half of his blood by the time they got him to the waiting table. Yeah. So there was plenty of blood to go around. There was a vial of blood that they took for testing purposes to determine what he had in the system and that sort of thing. And over the, that blood got put in a storage facility, and over the years kind of got forgotten. And then a nurse found it and stole it and took it home, and she passed away. And then her son found it, and her son decides he wants to sell it on eBay. And this was not a good situation. Mrs. Reagan called me and said, "Have you read this story about Ronnie's blood?" And I said, "Yeah." She said, "You're going to go get it." And we had, I mean, lots of lawyers, lots of threats, you know, I mean, we came after them, and they voluntarily gave it up. They got so scared of what might occur. And so that blood now sits in the safe that's in my old office in the, at the Reagan Library. It just would have been ridiculous. You know, you can't let something like that.
So did they give it up like no problems? They just say, "Oh, here's the blood," or did it take a lot of threats? It
took about a week of lawyers with big sharp fangs, you know.
It's just fascinating. I think, by the way, if you're out there, you've never been to the Reagan Library, it's a phenomenal facility. The work that John did to build it, I've had the pleasure of going there and getting a tour from John and kind of going even into some rooms and things that maybe not everybody gets to go to, and just absolutely fascinating. And whether you're a fan of Reagan or not, I happen to be, but whether you're a fan or not, it's a major part of American history. And it's just hard not to even walk through those halls and not kind of just feel the vibe, you know. And it must have been pretty cool to go there every day, John.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, and that, the thing is, when you hear the word library, you know, you just think some big place with a lot of books on the shelves. It's just so much more than that. It's an enormous museum. There's, you know, you can climb aboard Air Force One and take a tour of it. You know, you can, there's events and special exhibits and concerts and presidential debates. I mean, it's a very, very active cultural center, you know, that where many, many things happen. And it's the most visited of all the presidential libraries by like 3 to 1.
And Air Force One is inside the museum.
You guys remember Boone Pickens?
Yeah, sure.
Well, Boone wrote a $50 million check to put a big glass case around Air Force One so that the library could accept the plane from the Air Force. Boone was on the board of the Reagan Foundation at the time.
How did they get it there? I never asked that question.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting because that it's there were two Air Force Ones during Reagan's time, both of them 707s. And this one was essentially being surplus. It had finally reached the end of its useful life. But every president from Reagan, actually from Lyndon Johnson on to George W. Bush has flown aboard that aircraft. And we were crafty enough to get the Senate to appropriate the funds to allow the Air Force to surplus. And then we had to buy the plane and build all this stuff, you know, around it. And but well worth it, because something like 30% of all visitors to the Reagan Library come specifically to get aboard Air Force One.
Sure.
So were a lot of other libraries fighting for that plane if so many presidents had been in it?
Other museums. And Bob, to your question, so its last flight was out to an Air Force base here in California. They took the wings off, they took off the tail, they flew it in pieces. They had to shut down I-5, and, you know, really something. But, you know, it took about a year to reassemble, and it now, if you just charge up the batteries and put gas in it, you can fly it away. It was restored by GE and Boeing to flying condition.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's fabulous.
You know, the great thing about this conversation, we haven't talked a lot about economics, because I was going to tell you guys, I know you all know economics backwards, forwards. When I'm thinking about starting a GoFundMe campaign for me to make up for my lack of knowledge in economics. So if you guys would be interested in contributing to that.
Yes.
You need to make that for Bitcoin.
on the monitor. Mel's going to give you your address. I'm going to send you my book, and you'll become a monitor.
Very good. I'd love to read it.
You'll become a monetary expert in 12
hours. I'll send you one, too.
Yeah.
I'll send you Bitcoin and the American Dream if Mel will give me that address, so you'll get another one.
We'll give you a reading list. If you probably read 10 books, you'll be 80% of where you need to be. I mean, have you heard The Creature from Jekyll Island by Edmund Griffith? You know that book?
Nope.
That's a must.
Okay. No, that's a must read.
It's on the creation of the Fed. Yeah, it's basically the creation of the Fed, John.
I mean, you know, I don't know how much Bob told you about us, but, you know, as you know, we're all Bitcoiners. And, you know, our belief and my belief, and I think Bob's and Gary's too, is that really the monetary system is what's led to the broken nature of our country today. You know, the system is set up to benefit, you know, the politicians and the banks and the Federal Reserve are all kind of a cabal, and they got together. And they rigged the system in their favor, and that's why we have the wealth inequality, and that's why we have 30% interest rates, and it's really why America's not, you know, the America that we all grew up in. I don't know where you grew up, John. Where did you grow up? What area of the country were you in?
McLean, Virginia, right outside Washington, D.C.
Yeah, I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I think Bob grew up in Wisconsin. I'm not sure. Gary, where did you grow up?
Charleston, South Carolina.
Yeah. As we all recall, I mean, there was really a vibrant middle class when we were growing up. My dad was a shopkeeper, and the guy who ran Ford lived down the street from us. He probably made 4 or 5 times what my dad made, but he didn't make 400 times what my dad made. Do you know what I mean? And it was just, you know, it was just a fairer, more balanced system. Probably the biggest crime of our lives that I know I remember, and you probably do too, you're probably similar ages, was Nixon going off the gold standard in 71. That was a really, really bad thing. I mean, when we abandoned sound money in 1971, that was the beginning of the end. Now, we had enough institutional momentum because, you know, in 46, we stood at the top of the world having won World War II, that, you know, and all the other countries were destroyed. So that, you know, we coasted on that momentum for a long, long, long time. But, you know, the rot and the creep just came in, and pretty soon, you know, you had Cheney saying deficits don't matter, and you had politicians saying, you know, we got to go make the Middle East safe so we can grab all their oil. And the next thing you know, you've spent $8 trillion and maimed a lot of people. And, you know, it's all friggin' tragic. It's absolutely tragic. And, you know, I know that in my case, I think really in all three of our cases, we're all working and supporting Bitcoin because we really believe that Bitcoin is the way out of this thing. If we go back to a sound money standard, and that could involve gold, by the way, too. Gold is, the way we like to look at it, is gold is analog sound money, and Bitcoin is digital sound money. And both of them have the advantage of being distinct from the government. And the reason the government's gotten away with all this stuff and it's become so out of control, as you alluded to earlier, is that they can print money into existence. And so the temptation to do that is so large, and they do it, and that keeps them in power. And you know, the cost, they don't see the cost, but the cost is the, you know, the working class man or woman who goes to the grocery store and suddenly ground beef is $9 instead of $2, you know, because of all the inflation. So it's really problematic, you know.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I remember I was on the budget committee staff in Congress, and at the time, federal budget deficit was nearing this like all-time high of like several hundred billion, and the national debt not yet $1 trillion.
Right.
But we could eyeball it and see in 3 or 4 years if the spending kept on the path it was going to be $1 trillion, and that just was a mind blower, right? And now you think about where we are today, it's absurd. And
of course it is. I in the book I go through that. I mean, I remember how everyone was down on Reagan for the deficits and just how irresponsible the Reagan deficits were, and they were 100-200 billion dollars, and that was quaint by comparison. And one could even argue, and he also got a lot of real GDP growth. I mean, there were a few years in there we grew 4-6% a year as a result of all that, and that's what led to the failure of the Soviet Union. So one could actually make an argument that it did make sense to deficit spend there. The problem is, guys like Dick Cheney and other guys picked up on it and said, hey, Reagan proved that deficits don't matter. So
yeah.
They stepped up. Yeah.
In fact, if you look back at the Reagan years, just like you said, people say, well, he didn't cut the deficit. No, but he did something that was unprecedented at the time. He cut the rate of growth of federal spending. That was like the best you could do, right? Because Reagan never owned the Congress. He had Democrats were in charge of the House of Representatives all 8 years of his presidency.
I forgot about it. Yeah.
I had two.
Yeah.
So everyone
was Tip O'Neill, wasn't it? Or was he the chairman of Speaker of the House?
Yeah, it was Tip O'Neill and then Jim Wright, who was Speaker.
Yeah, right.
Everything was a compromise, right? So the best you could do was cut the rate of growth of the size of the federal government. You couldn't cut the government size itself. Now, Trump's been trying to do it, but, you know, even there are all sorts of puts and takes, and, you know, we're still on this terrible path.
Those was a noble.
If I remember correctly, Reagan was and I was just going to say, if I remember correctly, wasn't Reagan super big on trying to get to the line item veto, which he never could get?
Yeah.
I think that would make an astounding difference.
Yeah. Well, go back to the fundamental of all fundamentals, and that is it would just get a true balanced budget act passed.
Yeah, right.
You know, but you know, now we're so far off the cliff. I mean, to balance the federal budget, it would take like Bitcoin sized, you know, value and remarkable. We'd have to cut half of the federal budget as it exists today. Yeah. You know,
it's one of the good macro analysts that we follow says you basically have to cut Social Security, Medicare, and defense spending by 50% for the next 15 years. Good luck with that.
Yeah. Well, here's another one. In 2 years, our interest payment on the debt alone is going to exceed all the money we spend on all discretionary programs and all of our defense budget.
Yeah.
And then by 2050, interest on the debt alone will exceed the entire federal budget.
You know what's
we won't make
what I think is
about a collapse. Yeah.
I think this review of kind of where we were in the Reagan era and comparisons where we are now is really important because I think a lot of younger people and even older people probably have no concept as like, how did we get here? And you know, Larry, for us in the kind of coming from the Bitcoin world and that have really kind of dug into economics, 71 was a big deal, like the Nixon removal of us from the gold standard.
That was temporary.
Well, yeah, he's temporarily suspending the redemption of dollars for gold was how it was categorized how he stated. But I think what's interesting about Reagan, you know, since we're kind of focused there, was that happened in 71. Then by the late 70s, we have the Carter administration, we have inflation running out of control. It kind of was the foreshadow of kind of what was going to happen, like this chaos, because now the relationship of really all responsibility was gone and accountability. There's a guy in the Bitcoin world that his name's Jack Mallers, a young guy, kind of one of the guys I think that a lot of us find promising about the future. I don't know, he's maybe in his early 30s, but he has this phrase that I give him a lot of credit for, and he says, no man should have to work for what another man can print. And I think it's a wonderful way of categorizing it, and what we've done, in this case, the man, is the government. So, you know, at that point, fiscal responsibility became completely... it really didn't matter anymore, right? I mean, tax revenue didn't even matter, that they could print whatever they wanted. And the U.S. has this very preferred position too, that because the rest of the world is dependent on the dollar, it's the reserve currency of, we kind of export inflation. So when we grow the money supply, we feel it, but But about 80% of the impact of that growth is actually felt outside our borders, not inside, which I find kind of immoral and ethical that, you know, that be the case. How do you think, John, if Reagan, ask you to go inside Reagan's head for a minute here. So if Reagan was president right now and he was looking at this situation, how do you think he would react to $38 trillion and at least the fiscal side of this?
Yeah, well, okay. So let's wind the clock back first. When Reagan came into office, post-Carter, as you say, inflation was 13.5%. Interest rates were 20%. Marginal tax rates were 70%. I mean, this, thank God I wasn't working at the time. I was in college or something. What did I care? You know, but when Reagan came in office and these kinds of conditions existed, I don't know how people made it. You know, I mean, so 2 years later, Reagan lost 26 Republican seats in the House and a few seats in the Senate. And why is that? You know, I remember at the time the mantra was on the Republican side, Reagan was saying, stay the course, you know, fiscal discipline, all that stuff. And the Republicans in Congress were saying, yeah, stay the curse, meaning the pain was so great they'd all thought they were going to lose because they started voting against this federal spending and what have you. And Reagan did lose 26 seats. There's a price to be paid by being fiscally disciplined, right? It's why you see this to this very day, even Republicans are jumping ship, you know, Trump ship for certain things because they're just trying to preserve their power or basically preserve their seat in Congress. So I have, you know, I watched the phenomenon of Trump in the mid-2015s, and I'm now fully convinced myself. What Trump does is he wakes up in the morning, he goes under the bed, he grabs this binder and it's the Reagan playbook. I mean, if you think about what Reagan stood for, Trump's trying to do many of those things, a strong national defense, lower taxes, and, you know, from a economic, from a monetary policy standpoint, as you all know, I mean, he's probably the first and only president that has been pro crypto, you know, pro Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. He thinks like a fiscal conservative. Now, does he have the ability to pull it off in the modern day, especially with the complexion of Congress like it is? Whole nother question. You know, I mean, it's now almost like it's like become Mount Everest, you know, and not many people have got enough oxygen to make it up there on their own. So I now put in a hypothetical, put Reagan in charge. First, he'd fall over dead at the size of the debt. I mean, and he would be urging us to cut spending like you can't believe. He'd also be, you know, pushing for, you know, supply side style tax cuts and the rest. But I genuinely think we're beyond the day when those things can work. I mean, I really do believe that. I mean, a lot of people don't want to hear this, but I believe there needs to be a revolution of some kind because the situation gets so bad that there's no choice but for everything to be turned upside down. And maybe that's when there's, you know, Bitcoin has its moment. Until then, it's not as though Bitcoin doesn't make perfect sense like gold does. However, my view, I'm trying to understand how do you get there from here? With every vested interest, every economic interest in the United States based in the current system. I don't think it's just going to take a couple pieces of legislation and a president that favors it. I mean, you're asking everybody in Washington who's built their whole careers on power and controlling the monetary policy to say, give up and go home. And I don't think that's going to be an easy fight.
And John, do you think Reagan would be a Bitcoiner?
Yeah, I do. Because he was always, I mean, think about this. Let's take technology on the what people used to call Star Wars. Yeah, STI. I mean, Ronald Reagan had visions of Golden Dome and everything that we're now spending money on 40 years ago. I mean, so he was a great outside the box thinker, and he was, you know, he was the one, he invested enormous amount of funds in modernizing the American military through technology. And so, yeah, I do think he'd be a Bitcoiner. Remember Paul Volcker was the head of the Federal Reserve under Reagan. And with the interest rates as high as it were, Reagan kind of went like this. He's like, the Fed has to, you know, we don't have any choice at the time.
You're telling me, right?
Yeah. We've tightened monetary policy and put people's lives in misery for a couple of years to get inflation down. And once we do that, we can get on back on a better path. And, you know, that is what happened. However,
it was scary for the first couple of years because he didn't know if it was going to work. And it's like you say,
That was the stay the curse part.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we bought a condo then, and interest was 17%, if I remember correctly, or something.
Those 20% rates almost put my dad out of business. The thing I loved about Reagan was he always, you know, he was jolly and happy and positive, but he always understood, you know, that government was the fundamental problem. You know what I mean? And he came out of that, you know, Goldwater, libertarian, West Coast, you know, view that, you know, kind of, we just, you know, who needs a federal government? And to the degree we have one, you know, let's rein it in as much as possible.
Yeah, with
the exception of standing up to the Russians, which, you know, one could argue that was a good use of federal government time and resources. So.
Yeah. In fact, you just almost stated the line exactly. That's the most famous line from Reagan's first inaugural address, which was, government is the problem.
I can't remember. Is that exactly what you said? I thought it was something similar to that.
Yeah.
But I think he said the scariest words are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help you.
Yeah. On the economic side with Reagan, as remarkably positive some of Trump's actions have been, I don't think he's still not done something that has been as big as defeat the entire Soviet Union, right? I mean, that changed the world forever, or at least hopefully forever. And the way he did it was, was an economic policy? Yeah, in a way it was, because what he essentially did was he looked at Gorbachev and he said, we have economic might, we're going to use it, and we're going to build, you know, a defense system like you've never seen. And that was the moment when the Soviets just said, we can't afford this, you know, we give up. That's essentially the play, but it did cost some money. We had to rebuild American defenses to make it happen.
You know, when Russia was invading Afghanistan back during that time period, I guess, basically, I always
Soviets.
I always felt like that the end was coming for them soon because they were overexpanded, that it would be impossible to keep up with what was going on financially and stuff. Do you ever feel like the United States is in that situation right now, that we are overexpanded?
Carbon copy. Yep. Well, okay. at least during the, you know, roughly the last 10, 12 years, the whole Iraq, Afghanistan foray, I mean, you know, what we should have done is, you know, we should have gotten a lot of bombers, and over a 10-year period, just struck one time after another from the air and killed whatever we saw moving that looked anything like Osama bin Laden. But we sure as hell should not have put boots on the ground in Iraq and in Afghanistan. I mean, a complete waste of time and money. And we were just way overextended on that front. And it probably added a couple $1 trillion to our national debt. So now, military strategists would say, well, you can't beat those guys unless you have boots on the ground. And I think our posture should, but we're not looking at beating, we're looking at punishing them.
and/or just keep them out of our country.
Yeah.
Do you look, John, at the way that Trump is handling Venezuela, which, you know, hitting the drug boats, seizing the tankers, obviously kidnapping Maduro as a more economically efficient way of trying to achieve something similar?
Yeah, well, Venice, first, and there'll be a lot of people I know don't agree with me, but I support every single decision he's made with respect to Venezuela. And, you know, for lots of reasons, but it's a big national security umbrella. I mean, they are the greatest transit point from which drugs in South America, Central South America flow. It kills a lot of people. That's one good reason alone. The second is they ripped us off. We used to have oil companies down there making money hand over fist, and they took that away from us. You know, but third, they, you know, they, I think people don't really fully understand to the extent that China and Russia and Iran were making the country of Venezuela a platform from which to continue to screw with our national security.
And that's the part that I observed. It reminded me, it was like the Cuban Missile Crisis. I mean, this is a country in our hemisphere that's very close by, and we've got these three state actors that we really don't like, you know, taking over. And that, I think that, you know, some people say Trump struck Venezuela. I think he did. I actually think more, I think the CIA actually made the call or the Department of Defense.
Well, remember Trump came right out and said, yeah, well, we're sending the CIA in there. I mean, yeah. It was, you know, very bored about it, and he was right, you know.
Well, you know, but we went and kidnapped the president of Panama, and I don't remember this much action or negativity toward capturing him, and he didn't do near as much as we were seeing from Maduro.
Listen, we're either going to act like the superpower we are or we're not, you know, and if our interests are being threatened, we have to act. And I think Trump understands that. He actually does what he says. I think now, you know, Trump can shoot from the hip rhetorically, but I think the world now understands that when he says something just like Reagan, he really means it. And that's good. I think that's good to keep people on their toes in that regard.
John, I'm curious, you know, one of the, if I can shift just a tiny bit, one of the reasons we do this show, and it's called The Bitcoin Boomers, is Gary, Larry, and I, we're within the Bitcoin community and the Bitcoin cohorts, we're kind of the elders to a certain degree. And there's a couple others, but there frankly aren't many, at least that are prominent and vocal. And part of what we're here for is to try to get our generation that we share with you a little more involved, a little more engaged. And, you know, it's hard because Bitcoin is a strange thing. It's not like a startup company. We're not like AI. There's no company like OpenAI or Grok or Google out championing it. There is no leader. There's no central authority. And what it often means, I think, is that the narrative, the proper narrative, certainly doesn't get to people. And in fact, the opposite's true, that we've certainly come to find that over the last decade or so that the three of us have been involved, that if we look at major media outlets, whether that's CNN or the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, they've been adversarial. And so I think one thing that I would be curious about is, especially given, you know, your extensive background, the fact that you keep current with world events, you know, how do you perceive Bitcoin and what kind of things out there make you question it or the things that are unclear to you, like kind of how do you?
And in your peer group, I mean, the people you hang out with,
yeah.
You seem to kind of get it, but do you find that to be the case for your peers or not?
Yeah, I have a good buddy who's a home builder, or he tries to be a home builder here in California, which is not easy. He's told me this story a few times about this friend of his at the time was a billionaire who made his wealth in the gaming industry. And this was how many years ago? I guess it's when $10,000 would buy you a lot of Bitcoin. So you guys tell me how many years ago that was.
Probably 12 years ago.
Yeah. Okay. And this guy went to my buddy, the home builder, who was fairly well off, but he was in some struggle because there was some issues with permitting and that kind of things. So the guy said to him, look, just give me $10,000. You ought to bet on this thing called Bitcoin. My friend Brian's like, what? What's that? He said, no, just $10,000. I'm telling you, you're going to make a mint, you know. And Brian said, no, I don't have the excess cash at this point. And so to this day, he's like, he's saying, how many $1 billion would I be worth?
Yep.
You know, if I had done that. So there's, in my peer group there, I'll tell you how my peers feel. They probably feel like me. We missed the boat, goddammit. It was like, you know, if you brought it to me today, I'd be in. But man, it's too late. Everybody got in early. You know, they've done wonderfully. And no matter when they pass, they will have done wonderfully. Good for them. And good for them. It's just that it's like the train that left the state. It's almost like, Bob, it's like, if you weren't into building AI 10, 12 years ago, you know, you're way behind the curve now. Or if you weren't into, what, pick an industry in the tech sector. And, you know, if you didn't get in early, you'll never really be a winner.
If you started a home company in 2010, you were too late, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it's not as though they wouldn't like a lot of it if they could get their hands on it at some reasonable price. And I know that would be the topic would be what's reasonable, but I missed the train, you know?
People feel that way. And it's sad that it's a price bias. I mean, just to draw a comparison to that, I think Amazon is probably the best performing, one of the best performing stocks other than NVIDIA, which we're just running nuts, but a comparable to Bitcoin is Amazon, because it came out, before the GFC in the early 2000s, when the internet got started, and it's up 288,000% from the time when it came. And I recall a lot of people, in the 2008 period, the 2010 period, the 15 period, all saying, oh gosh, yeah, I wish I'd gotten in on that, but you guys have made a ton of money, but you're too late. Well, it just kind of kept going.
But the people who bought at $100 said the same thing, because they said, I could have got this at a nickel. And the people who bought it at $1,000 said the same thing.
People got it for a dollar. And
Some
of us got it for $10,000. Some of us got it for a couple thousand or less. And someday, it's $100,000, just under $100,000 a day. I mean, in 10 years, 15 years, people say, you bought your Bitcoin for below $1 million. And I bought one.
Exactly.
For
yeah.
And it's $1 million now. In fact, when I sign books at my book conference, when I go to the shows to sign books, I always put the Bitcoin price in there and the date, because I want whoever receives the book, I know their kids will look at that book someday and say, hey, Mom or Dad met the guy who wrote this thing. And gosh, when they got this book, it was only $70,000. And it's $3 million today.
That's a good idea, Larry.
It's just going to keep on marching. Do you know what I mean?
Go ahead, John.
Well, I was just going to say, I maybe 5% of the peers I know have been wise enough to figure out a way to make it at least some percentage of their portfolio, right? I'm not going to miss out on this. And they can afford to be that diversified. And they'll treat Bitcoin just like they would treat gold, But I would say probably the impediment to boomers like myself and others in my peer group is that, you're just so damn busy. For me, I'd be thinking, okay, if it's at 90,000 today or something, I think in these big round terms, like I need to get one Bitcoin.
I know.
But it's like a lack of sophistication and understanding how you can get in without having to buy one big solid coin,
there's a price buy. It's one of the reasons some of the other cryptos exist. Like, we are all Bitcoin purists. Like, we would say, don't mess with any of the other shit. It's all tainted. but it attracts other people because it might be $3 or $12 or $20.
This is the next Bitcoin. You know what I mean?
But there is no such thing. Yeah. But you know, I think one of the, it's valuable because we live in a cocoon, John, or in our own echo chamber. It's valuable to hear from other people because it helps us kind of prioritize how we talk about it. And I think one of the things I'll offer just a little bit more to what Gary and Larry have said relative to the you're too late. The first thing is to understand that there's only 21 million Bitcoin. And, you know, remember when you just said it, like, hey, if I could only get one, like, which would be a little under $100,000 right now. Well, if there's only, there's four times more millionaires in the world than there are Bitcoin in the world. So it's almost, and we're at a point where, and that scarcity can't change. Like, so it's different than anything else, whether it's a stock or whether it's gold or anything else. We've never had an asset in the world other than maybe a Monet painting or a collectible item where a true commodity had a fixed supply. And you could think of it as we're competing against, remember what I said before, what man should work for what another man can print. There is no limit on the money printer. So as that printer keeps rolling, and you've even said it yourself, like we're headed toward a revolution. And whether that's a violent revolution or an economic catastrophe, you know, with some or some combination of the two, it is a separation from that. So the way, you know, and Larry wrote a great book on this, but we view it as there is no limit. And even if we wanted to put it in current terms, there's about $90 trillion of assets in the world today.
900.
There's only 21 million Bitcoin. So you could make an argument that the appropriate price for Bitcoin could be as high as $40 million per Bitcoin. Because that's what 21 million times...
900 trillion.
Or divided into that is. So that's one thing. The second thing I'll say, though, and it's even Bitcoiners miss this a lot, is that there's Bitcoin the asset and there's Bitcoin the monetary system. So Bitcoin is not just an asset. It is an alternative money system. So it gets its value. Do you remember Metcalfe's Law, John, by chance from your computer days? So it's, you know, for those that don't know, it's the power of a network is equal to the square of the number of users of the network. So it's a term, and whether that's cell phones, whether that's personal computers, whether that's whatever, but it applies to monetary systems too. So as adoption of Bitcoin increases, the value of the network increases, its usability increases. And we're at a point in the adoption of Bitcoin as a monetary network where it already moves more value annually than Visa and MasterCard combined. So very few people would probably understand that's how much movement of money. And it's doing so in a frictionless way. There's no approvers. Right now, at least, those are very inexpensive transactions. I could, if I had $1 billion, I could send you $1 billion, John, for about $2. And I could do it in 10 minutes. The existing monetary system cannot compete with that. And if you think about it, we can even back up a little geopolitically, and you think about that, what does that mean for a nation state? So like Russia, which when Russia invaded the Ukraine, one of Biden's first actions, I think it was a mistake, was to kick them off of the SWIFT system. And the reality is all it did is it forced them toward Bitcoin. The Russians now, their foreign trade minister openly admits that is a major part of how they do international commerce now is, you know, selling oil and buying oranges using Bitcoin. Yeah. So where I'm getting at is where it's at the, whether it's at the nation state level or the corporate level or the individual level, the removement of government or an overseer from the process is part of it. And we'll even use Reagan's words, right? You know, government is the problem. Well, let's get them the hell out of money and the monetary system.
Yeah, no, I get it. Knowing what little I do about where Bitcoin stands in the halls of Congress and halls of government is, you know, I think Bitcoin is absolutely ultimately going to succeed as, you know, it's digital gold. It's an asset. The world will treat it that way. Washington will treat it that way. I think the industry is in this interesting situation, which every industry goes through. And that is, it's looking for nods of approval and respect and, you know, ultimately regulation that allows the system to grow and flourish. So the good news is it's well on its way towards getting the necessary regulatory framework to thrive. It's just one of those be careful what you wish for things, right? Because, you know, in a regulatory framework, you're inviting all sorts of mischief, you know, and will the industry be happy with how Washington treats it purely from an asset perspective? How do you tax it? You know, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Where the Mount Everest that I see is when the Bitcoin wants to move as it wants to go from an asset, digital asset, to becoming the money supply. You know, that's a big term, and that is because it forces every single player in the current system to cede their power, right? And so how do you bring that about? That's really, you may have lots of very conservative fiscal restraint Republicans that would say, yeah, we ought to move to a system that's highly efficient that doesn't involve the government and the rest of that. But in saying and doing that, they are giving up, they are ceding power to another.
Absolutely.
Right? And why do you get elected? To gain power and to use power. Right? So that's why I always feel like, on its way to becoming truly the money supply or the monetary system, it has to achieve something that I don't know that any civilization in history has ever achieved at this level, and that's going to be difficult.
I think our view, the way we're going to get there, John, you're right. They're never going to give it up voluntarily, just like they're never going to enact term limits. And rather sadly, because it's going to be a painful episode when it happens, but rather sadly, what's going to happen is the currency is going to fail. You know, we're gonna have a hyperinflation event, and at that point in time, you know, there'll be a brief period where there's a little bit of chaos, and then we'll say, okay, what kind of money can we trust? And the only choices are going to be gold, silver, and Bitcoin.
If the United States currency fails, that means the world's currency fails.
That's correct.
Right? I mean, given everybody's so tethered to it, right? And so the world. That's why I've always, people will say, you know, well, this country's so divided, right and left, where, you know, everybody's gone to their distinct corners. There's no middle anymore. How do we get Americans to rally with each other and unite? It's like, yeah, well, what history has proven is you need some absolutely tremendous calamity, like a World War II or Pearl Harbor, something. Yeah. That's what it takes to get people's frameworks completely altered to change.
Right. And, well, everybody got together after 9/11, John.
Yep. I mean,
prove your point.
And if that's what needs to happen to our monetary system, it's not going to be pretty. And I don't know for how long, you know, but I know that'll be an earth-shaking event, like something we've never seen before.
I think that's right.
Hey, John, if I could go back a second to your statement that you were kind of like thinking you needed one Bitcoin, a whole Bitcoin. I just want to put this out there. From what I understand, to be in the top 1% of people that own Bitcoin, you only need a fourth of a Bitcoin. So you really don't need a lot of Bitcoin to have a lot of Bitcoin.
Yeah, no, I get it. And you know, after having this conversation, see, one of the other, probably the worst thing that happened to me in my labor at Gateway was, like many other corporations, Gateway offered me, well, you know, you're in the executive, you're in the C-suite now, so we're going to free of charge provide you with a financial advisor. And of course, here comes Goldman, right? And they, you know, Goldman, I don't know the advantage of it, Bob, but you know,
Goldman. Yeah, I had that too, John.
Yeah, so because I was so busy, you know, doing whatever I was supposed to be doing in my work life, I said, okay, I'll outsource all my financial advice and thinking and decisions to this thing called Goldman. To this day, you know, all my everything is tied up and Goldman manages it. Well, it made me stupid, you know, basically, right? I mean, how much do you think about economics when there's some paid person who's thinking about economics for you, you know? And but Goldman as an institution, I know, has been down on Bitcoin for quite some time. You know, they're not the JP Morgans of the world. And but this conversation is going to lead me to start asking some pretty tough questions of my financial advisor as to why I don't have Bitcoin as part of my diversified mix. You know,
I love that, John, because I think that's what you go to your friend, right? So your friend, we'll call it a decade or so ago, had, even as a billionaire, putting $10,000 in Bitcoin at that period would have been life-changing. Had Bitcoin gone to zero, it wouldn't have changed his life at all.
That's
right. So I think, I write a monthly newsletter now for Financial Advisor Magazine. It goes to 400,000 wealth and financial advisors. And that's part of what I've been telling them for several years now, is I say, hey, you're going to have to be accountable to the people who years ago said to you, what about Bitcoin? And you said, no, it's too risky, it's speculative, it's a Ponzi, you know, whatever it is. Well, it's not. It's roughly the sixth most valuable asset in the world. It's roughly on par with Amazon right now. And you told them for all these years to stay away. And now you have a difficult situation, because what's happening is a lot of them are pivoting. Morgan Stanley and, you know, Fidelity, and even like Vanguard has now changed their tune. Like, how do you do that? How do you go to them and say, oh, now, like you said, I feel like I missed the boat. So you're going to go to them after they feel like they missed the boat,
yeah,
and tell them now to get in? Like, it's very, very weird situation. And they were dead wrong. Obviously they were dead wrong, and they didn't do the work.
A lot of their own vested interests are all about keeping Bitcoin out. Right. I mean,
well, that, you know, right. I mean, it's, they make money from selling stocks, and so they're going to sell.
Yeah.
Stocks. Yeah.
Yeah. That's right.
So it's, I mean, I've often said it's only a matter of time until somebody brings a class action lawsuit against these advisors and says, hey, you know, this is the best performing financial asset in the last 16 years. Why didn't I own any? That's your job, is to put me in these good assets. You know, I'm going to sue you for malpractice. I mean, I don't know how much traction they'll get on that, but the point is that, you know, people are being forced to reckon with it. And
yeah, you know, I don't know. And you guys have probably thought about this, but I'm trying to understand is what parallels, if any, exist behind the evolution of AI and Bitcoin. You know, and I just say that because, you know, the world right now is, half of it's on fire. You know, say, I can't wait for AI. Think of the productivity gains I'm going to get. Go, go, go. You know, and who cares about the rules, whatever. And the other half is scared to death. I'm going to lose my job. You know, this is going to be the end of the world. You know, robots will run the world. And it's like, okay, well, the truth is somewhere in between. But it's an accelerated the situation is just accelerating. Where these AI advances are upon us quicker than we even know. And I'm wondering, it just makes sense to me that from a monetary standpoint, I'm not surprised that the digital economy is going to just move along with AI. And that's going to be a lot of wind at its back, I think. I'd be interested in your viewpoint on that.
Well, I think. Go ahead, Larry.
No, I agree with that. Yeah, I agree with what he said.
Yeah, yeah. I think. I mean, there's a lot there. I mean, that's probably a whole episode in and of itself, John. But I'll say a couple things. You know, one as it pertains to AI. I think AI is going to need a currency. And the logical currency of AI is Bitcoin. So I think there will be a correlation as this thing matures. Yeah. And in fact, there's interesting examples. If you look at, let's say, a Tesla car, and instead of thinking as of the car as owned by somebody, you think of the car itself as a entity which wants to preserve itself. I'll use this as an example. Well, it can drive off literally out of the factory and start earning money. It can start giving rides. And it can collect and know that it has that it can collect Bitcoin and know that it's getting it. And it knows when it needs a recharge. It knows when it needs new brakes. And it has a currency by which it can sustain itself. And so I think that's an easy example for people to get, but you know, it could be a robot. It could be even a completely virtual agent that now has a mechanism by which it can do. It's kind of scary shit, but and it's wild, you know, to think about. I think it will happen way faster, you know, even though all of us are in the back nine of life, I think we will see this in our lifetime, you know, and probably even within the decade, we'll see these sorts of things fulfill themselves. I think interestingly, John, we came through an industry, the personal computer industry, and we look at the way it changed the world, the way adoption occurred, the way it changed labor and like all those sort of, and I think, you know, that was a foreshadow. This will be a bigger impact, but yeah. You know, what happened, I think you entered in the mid 90s, right? I think that's when you came to Gateway. So you came in and we started working together almost at the inflection, a key inflection point, I would say. You know, you entered there. I happened to start about 15 years before that. And, you know, we went through the classic curve of, the innovators, the early adopters, the early majority. I think you came right as we were leaving the early majority and kind of entering the mainstream. And that next 6-7 years, which were when we worked together at Gateway, were kind of, that was the real glory day. You know, of that. And that's where the world changed, because prior to that, and I'm sure you remember that, prior to when you joined, was it like 96, 97, John, something like that?
Yeah,
96. So, you know, we didn't have broadband. There really was no internet. People were largely using their personal computer to do things like word processing and spreadsheets. They maybe had an email account, but it was through AOL. It was a very different kind of world. And what happened over the next 7-8 years is, you know, it changed everything, right? We went from one PC maybe in each house or each classroom to every student has one, every desk in every business has one, everybody has their own laptop.
You know, mobile computing.
Yep. We saw administrative jobs collapse, right? Clerical jobs, administrative jobs, you know, completely collapsed, all those sort of things. But AI is leaps and bounds beyond that.
Yeah, I think that's it. You really put it well, Bob. It's almost like AI needs a monetary system that can keep up with it. You know, that's what it seems like. That'll be wind at its back.
Yeah. John, do you you mentioned like you're not really been active. You're letting Goldman kind of. You know, at a personal level, but do you view organizations, we'll use the Reagan Foundation, which I know you are no longer active, when they look at at managing their endowment or their trust. I'm not quite sure what structure you guys have. How do you see them looking at something like Bitcoin? And you're part of the, you know, so the Waite Family Foundation and philanthropic, you know, endeavors. How do you see them looking at it?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, when I started at the Reagan Foundation, I was stunned that its endowment was only like $30 million, and that, you know, that number, I mean, that would be enough to pay for 3/4 of a year of operations. I mean, it was just way too small. So we went on a huge development spree and rate, you know, by the time I left, we had $350 million in the endowment. And and interestingly enough, Goldman, Goldman manages that money too. The thing about Bitcoin and let's say the nonprofit world, which Reagan Foundation would be, so the entire nonprofit sector has a more conservative dial on their investment strategy than you would if you were a business or in private enterprise, right? Because, you know, you've got donors, not customers, and you have to watch every dollar like a hawk if you want to stay tax exempt and grow. So I would say, you know, like while any company, Microsoft or others, have this piece of Bitcoin in their investment portfolio, the harder nut to crack will be the major endowments, whether at Harvard or the Reagan Foundation, what have you, because they're just naturally like, oh man, if it's an asset that goes up and down and way too much, you know, they'll stay away. I think it'll take some stability and more broader acceptance, and it will reach the point where smart endowments and nonprofit in their nonprofit space will invest and will get involved. But I think at least at this point, it's probably, you know, further out on the horizon.
Larry Gere, I have a few other things for John, but they're kind of like way off in a completely different direction. What else do you guys got?
I'm good. I'd say go that direction or wrap, either way.
Okay.
I wonder how I get a personalized tour of the Reagan Museum next time out there like Bob got.
When you send me your book, just put a little card in it and I'll shoot you back. I'm happy to make that happen. You know, because they still like me enough that I can put you in the line and you get the kind of tour that Bob did. It's, you know, you get to literally sit at Reagan's desk and kind of look at
it. Yeah. That was the highlight, honestly. Yeah, I'll never forget that.
Sounds pretty great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but I have no questions, Bob. Go ahead. I mean,
okay. Well, we're going to kind of move off of Bitcoin, because I think maybe we'll close with this. I mentioned John is one of the most interesting people in the world. And simultaneous with running the Reagan Library, John authored a couple books, at least the first one, right, John? The first one you completed, at least while you were there. Did you do the second one too?
I did.
Second one. Yeah, and I had the pleasure of going to the Reagan Library, where we had the unveiling, John. I don't know what you would call that, where you unveiled the book. But the first book was called The Shroud Conspiracy, and it's a book I've read The Shroud Conspiracy and the sequel to The Shroud Conspiracy both a couple times. They're phenomenal books. I guess you wouldn't call it historical fiction, John. What would you call it? Maybe,
if you're familiar with the Da Vinci Code and, you know, that style.
Yeah.
It's a scientific religious thriller.
Yeah. And this one, as you can probably guess from the title, involves the Shroud of Turin so I think, John, maybe just kind of, you know, why did you write that book? And I'm also interested in your perspectives on the Shroud itself.
Sure.
And yeah.
Well, you know, when you bought the book, John.
Thank you. Both became bestsellers, which was kind of nice and somewhat of a fluke because I had never written novels before. When you're in politics, you better know how to communicate. So I knew how to write. I knew how to write well. One of my degrees is in English. And by the time I hit the Reagan Library, I had written every style of opinion pieces for Wall Street Journal or Times or the Washington Post, and presidential memorandum, speeches for the president, letters to constituents, every kind of writing you can imagine. I never thought I had the patience to sit there and write a full-length novel. And I thought, well, I'll just give it a try. So one night I came home, I chained myself to my desk, and I wrote the first paragraph, then the first chapter, and was on from there. But I never thought that anybody but my wife and kids would read it, if even them, you know. But when I, as a fluke, I sent it to somebody who said, hey, you need to get an agent. This is pretty good. So I did, and 3 weeks later, boom, Simon & Schuster picked it up, and we were off to the races. But the idea for this series is built on when I was 17 years old. I sat there, I'm Catholic. I went to a Catholic high school, and we sat in this religion class one day, and they showed this film by the Catholic Church, which is about the Shroud of Turin. And when you see the Shroud and you look at the image that's on that famous cloth, and you stare at it, and you're like, you've been raised, always kind of wonder, well, what does Jesus Christ, what did he actually look like? And you look at the Shroud, it's kind of stunning.
Have you seen it in person?
Yes, I have. Yeah. Now, it's not on display in the public very often. Because the church is hugely careful about lighting and, as an artifact, especially that old, you have to be extremely careful about exposing it to radiation, outside light, ultraviolet, all that. So it put the idea in my head that this is a story that could be very fascinating to write about. And 35 years later, it's still on my mind. I went... Bob Wood knows this fellow very well, Ted Waite, who I worked for after Gateway. I ran the Waite Institute. One of our projects was, let's go find the lost airplane of Amelia Earhart. So I went down in the South Pacific for 2 months aboard some really big ships trying to find her aircraft, based on formulas that would determine where she probably entered and crashed and the rest of that. But anyways, when you are vacuuming the ocean floor for 2 months, there's a lot of things that are, that you have a lot of time on your hands. And so it was on that trip that I developed the plot for the book. But I didn't write it right away. I waited till I was at the Reagan Library and I had some time. And so at nighttime, I just, for 6 months straight, every night I went and wrote this book. And it's about a historical anthropologist who was an atheist. To him, God's an absurd concept, and he's made a career and made a lot of money proving religious relics as fakes around the world. He does it using science and a great team of scientists. They're able to prove through carbon dating and any number of other means what's real and what's not. So I thought, well, why don't I put that to the test? I took this guy as the character who was asked by the Catholic Church to prove or disprove the authenticity of the Shroud of Turin, the burial cloth of Jesus Christ. And it's the book is kind of fascinating because it's not just a scientific whodunit, but it's a journey. It's not just a journey around the world. It's a journey of internally what happens to him when he discovers through scientific means that the Shroud is real. It is authentic. Because you can imagine as an atheist that throws his world into a total tailspin. Because now he has to believe that there really is, this thing called faith really has something behind it. And so the book's kind of a love story and a science story and a religious story. And it ends up getting very out there because in this plot, This group of individuals wants to steal a speck of blood from the shroud in order to recombine the DNA and create a second coming of their own through cloning of Jesus Christ. And so it's a big tale, and fortunately it sold really well. Hopefully, one of the things I'm spending in my lonely retirement is trying to figure out if I can get the books converted into a full-length feature film. And I'm making some progress. We'll see if it goes from where it goes from here.
Yeah, that was a
fascinating story.
Yeah, it is, and I remember, you know, John, even having that conversation with you right after the book was released, and reading it, that yeah, this is well, as Dan Brown stuff is, right? I mean, they've largely been turned into really great movies, or frankly, I don't think a movie does justice to it. I think it's better done as like a 10-part Netflix thing like that. So, yeah. Well, what do I know? But I will say this, and I appreciate you sharing this, John. I think to try to bring it back to Bitcoin, I think what is interesting and I encourage everybody to get the book, read the book. And if you're a Bitcoiner, think about the protagonist, Bondurant. John Bondurant, do I remember it right? He's an atheist and he becomes a believer. And I think there's an analogy to Bitcoin too, that there's a whole bunch of people out there that are non-believers, and part of what we're doing is, you know, we're converting them, much like through the truth, right? Yeah. Through the truth, you know, what is money? And John, you know, we view this, the three of us, I'm speaking for the three of us, you know, it's very much a good versus evil battle, that we think, you know, money and the abuse of the monetary system creates a great deal of, and maybe even almost all of, the problems of the world. And if we have a truthful form of money, we have a society.
Great analogy, Bob. Yeah, really. I mean, that's interesting. I think you're right. You're absolutely right. You know, in the end, the good conquers. So,
yeah.
Hey, John, I have a question on the shroud, real quick. This is a long shot, I know, but you don't happen to know who Russell Breault is, do you?
Russell, what's the last name?
Breault, B-R-E-A-U-L-T. He's a friend of mine who's been studying the shroud since 79, probably.
Wow, okay.
And so I would have been surprised if he hadn't read your book and messaged you or something. It's the only reason I asked.
Yeah, you know, in fact, there's an extraordinary exposition right now down in Orange County where there's a whole museum that is dedicated to the shroud and the controversy and the science and all the rest. So,
I knew it was a long shot, but I just thought I'd ask.
Another quick side story. As I didn't, in the plot of this book, one of the antagonists comes to find he has pancreatic cancer, and he's given just a few months to live. And I remember at the time as I was researching, what are the five worst cancers you can get? Pancreatic was like right at the top of the list. And I didn't know at the time, but as I was writing, I too had terminal cancer. And I was on the list of five. Oh. And I decided to finish the series before I passed. I was given 3 months to live. And boy, did that ever put me into a faith tunnel. But at the end of the day, you know, here I sit, having given less than 1% chance to live, just like the character in my book, who was also given a second life, but through very bad means. I'll just say that. So it's interesting how this world spins around sometimes. You know, by the way, I ended up, you know, I was asked this question when I launched the book, because a lot of people know about that story, especially those close to me. And I underwent 5 years of experimental treatments And finally, it was this combination of brand new immunotherapy drugs that I took. But interestingly enough, after the first immunotherapy treatment, I also got on a plane and I flew to Lourdes in France, where, especially if you're a person of faith in the Catholic faith, there's this, the site of a miracle.
Right. And I'm going there in April, John.
Are you? Okay. So I immersed myself in the springs of Lourdes. And when I came back 6 weeks later for the first time in 5 years, my scan showed it was clean.
Wow.
Like it was gone. Now people say, well, what did it? Was this the miraculous spring or was it the immunotherapy? And I say, I don't know. Maybe it was a combination of both. You were asking about that, Bob, in terms of the book. And I thought I'd just relate that story quickly.
Yeah. Well, I thank you for sharing that, John. Obviously, as your friend and somebody I respect tremendously, I'm so happy you're here. It is a blessing. I've sent plenty of prayers for you back in those days. And, you know, you had a bunch of prayer warriors fighting for you at that time. But I am a believer in such things. And Lola, my wife and I, we had last year, we went to a Barcelona and then we took we went up to see the Black Madonna.
I saw that. That's great.
Yeah, and just outside of Barcelona, and we actually just went to another site in the Philippines recently, where I forgot the name because it's a Filipino name. But anyway, what a wonderful story. And you know, John, I'm so happy that we got to do this. I think we talked about it probably a year ago doing something like this, but we finally pulled it off. And I think people are going to love this. I really, really enjoyed spending this time with you. Thank you.
You bet. Yeah. I learned a lot. So, thank you guys. I did. I learned a lot. And that's the next call I'm going to make is to Goldman Sachs.
Well, you get
yeah.
When you if get you need book, me, you'll have some ammunition. You say, hey, you got to read this book. You know, this will explain why.
I will. I tell you what, if you send me those books, I'll send you some copies of mine. How's that?
Sounds
like a deal to me, too. Hey, yeah. I just want to remind everybody, I got a message from Mel. Don't anyone turn their computers off when we get through until we get the okay.